Nice to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to be taking a look at what's going on in Wisconsin with our next guest, Mike Beno, back, editor of Our Wisconsin magazine. That magazine talks about some of the unique people, places, and events that you find in our state. And today we can talk about making violins or making swords and making maple syrup and a whole lot more. And always love to hear from you as well. Maybe your family has a fun thing to talk about, what they do to get together in the winter time, or maybe there's some events in your community you want to talk about. You can join in the conversation. Just give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Mike Beno, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry. It's great to be back. And, you know, you couldn't have invited us onto this show at a more propitious time. And I'm thanking you for that. And if you could indulge me with a brief explanation on my part as to why I really needed to visit with you today.
It has to do with the letter W, doesn't it?
As in, why does this stuff happen to me? Yes, for longtime readers of Our Wisconsin magazine, these folks are familiar with our Where's the W contest. We have a couple contests in the magazine where we try to inject a little bit of fun into our readers' lives. And in one of these, we hide three of the letter W for Wisconsin in the ads in the issue, and we challenge the readers to find them and then notify us by Carter letter as to the pages where those W's were hidden, and all those who are correct are put in a drawing for some really neat prizes that come from our advertisers. Maybe it's a gift card for dinner to Legend Larry's, or some snowshoes, or Bavaria sausage, hand-blown glass, you name it. There's some pretty cool stuff there. About 30 prizes in issue 30 to 40, depending how many advertisers are participating. Well, in the February-March issue, we hit our three W's, challenged the readers, said here's the 30 prizes, listed them, and out the magazine went. And here in the office, a great part about that contest is we instantly know when this magazine is mailed and on the street, because these readers challenge each other and families. They see how fast they can find them. They turn their cards in, so right away we're getting cards. Well, this past Friday, we didn't get any cards. Phone started ringing. And it rang, and it rang, and it rang some more. And our readers are all friendly folks, and we love to talk to them, but they were kind of ripping their hair out. You sure you hit three? Well, we've been doing this for 6 years. Yeah, we hit three. Yeah, we know what we're doing. Sure, we know. We're pros here. Yeah, right. We did some back-checking, and indeed, the readers are correct. We only hid two because there was a printing glitch at the nth hour in the process, dropped one off. It's too much technical to go through now, but one ain't in there. And there's a lot of people not going to need haircuts here in the wintertime because they're tearing their hair out. That's about the worst mistake we could make, because 12,000 people get in on this every time, Larry. So here's what we're doing, folks. Here's the plan. Everybody who's found two W's, we're telling everybody, get in and enter. We've got it on Facebook, Instagram, we've got it on our website, and we're telling all folks that call in, get in on this. Everybody's in on the drawing, two W's gets you in. And just to sweeten this up a little bit, we are doing not only 30 prizes, as we promised, we're adding five Culver's frozen custard prizes. That's Culver's for a year. Just to sweeten it up. Thank you, Larry. Thank you for that. And I've been on the phone quite a lot since Friday, and I just have just one quick one to share, because these folks are, hey, we're standing up and admitting we made an error. We're human. A lady named Chris Bodka of Nakusa. I spoke with her. We spoke with her a couple of days ago. She's a ham radio operator. I did not know that hobby still existed in the internet age, okay? So Chris is on channel 3985 daily and noon and 5 talking to folks all across the state, into Indiana, Minnesota, Michigan. She's all over the place in the Midwest, and she said, the whole buzz for two straight days on the ham radio is that were there really three W's in this magazine or not? And that's a good story idea. We got to do something on ham radio operators.
That's just what I was going to say. You need to do something on ham radio operators for sure.
There's positives in everything, Larry.
Well, you know, you certainly, I know sometimes if I make a mistake on the air, I find out that I do have people listening because they get a hold of me and let me know.
Well, today the swordsmith you're talking about said to me, you know, you've never made a mistake, and he said, until this issue, it's like this, the postage stamp with the inverted Jenny on it. It's quite valuable now. So, this issue of the magazine, February, March, is going to be worth an awful lot someday because you don't make errors, Mike.
Well, I tell you what. Well, you mentioned the sword maker, and I know I want to talk about the sword maker, so let's talk about that person because there again, here's another a really skilled person right here in Wisconsin who's doing something that not a lot of people can do.
Yeah. For those, you mentioned a little while ago, you mentioned public television. Well, folks who have watched public television over the past now 5 or 6 years may recall a Nova National Geographic special from 2012 that's been aired quite a lot called Secrets of the Viking Sword. There's a blacksmith who's up in Door County. His name is Rick Furr, F-U-R-R-E-R. That's pronounced Fur. And along the way of becoming a blacksmith, he got deeply into blade making, which is an ancient trade. It goes back to the Viking days, as we're going to talk about here in a moment. I mean, 800 AD, they were building blades, and even before that. So Nova took on a challenge, or issued a challenge, figured out they'd tackle it, and then issue it to a team. The Vikings had a sword they called the Ulfbert, which was made with advanced steel that none of their adversaries had or knew how to make it, and it was their secret weapon in battle. They made a 30.5-inch sword out of some specialized steel that weighed just 2 pounds, about like a baseball bat, and other steel shattered, other medieval steel shattered. This did not. How did they come up with that? How did they come up with that technology? They enlisted the services of metallurgists around the world, historians, and then they were led to Rick Furr in Sturgeon Bay, on a little area north of Sturgeon Bay, in his blacksmith shop, well known for making blades, everything from steak knives on up to swords. A lot of people do that, but the difference with Rick is, and here's a quote that's attributed to him. He says, to make a weapon from dirt is a pretty powerful thing. Rick takes iron ore. He takes carbon. He starts with stuff right out of the ground, makes the steel, smelts a wad of pure steel, and then starts on the days and days and days and days it takes to form that into a blade at high heat. Pounding relentlessly for hours and hours with a hammer, and one missed stroke of a hammer can break something, and you start over from scratch. So somebody that's this accomplished here in our state, a lot of people don't know about. He's got people traveling to see him from Australia, from countries all around the globe. His wife's a librarian in Sturgeon Bay, and she helped research all of this and bring it to the fore and actually help her husband. He learned blade making, by the way, from Paul Marks of Madison. And some blacksmithing from Orrin Loken, gunsmith and blacksmith in Fitchburg. So we've got a tradition of some of this here, and Rick this year is on his way to the Kingdom of Bhutan at the behest of the king, because there's only one sword maker still doing that ancient tradition there, and Rick is going to help them bring that back there because it's a big part of their tradition. Something unusual going on in Wisconsin, and these folks are everywhere, and that's why I think my job here is the best in the world, because I get to meet some of these people.
Yeah, it's really cool, and let's just shift right into the violin maker and teacher of violin, making violins as well.
Yes, that man, this is the beard issue. Those who
yeah.
may, flip open the magazine, we had a big bearded blacksmith I talked about a minute ago, and Brian Derber, the violin maker, is every bit his competitor when I take a look at the crop he's whiskers he's grown there, and there's a little bit of pepper in there, salt in there with the pepper, because Brian's been making violins with his beard for about 35 years. If somebody wishes in the United States wishes to learn the ancient trade of violin making, which worldwide dates to about the 1600s when Galileo was creating the sciences of astronomy and physics, you want to learn how to take a piece of wood and hand tools and make this into a concert-grade violin. There's four places in the United States you can go to school to learn it. That's Boston, Salt Lake City, Chicago, and Presque Isle, Wisconsin. In the middle of the North Woods, right on the border, it's where I live, and hidden away in the woods is the New World School of Violin Making, on a lake where the otters and timber wolves and loons all live. Now, students from New York, Montana, South Carolina, New Jersey, Colorado, on and on, travel here, live here for 3.5 to 4 semesters, give 3.5 years of their life to learn at the feet of a master named Brian Derber. Okay, Brian has a school in a walkout basement in his home, and people come here and invest that much time, but also he's got to be careful because he too is giving this much time to teach human to human this craft, and he needs to make sure these folks are really committed. Currently has one student named Ben DeCourcy from Appleton who is, but these students will take 4,000 hours of direct instruction from Brian, who started out as an industrial arts teacher. He's a woodworker, but he got into furniture making, then into violin making, learned it in Chicago, taught in Chicago for 8 years, people all around the world. And now they take a hunk of wood, they take finger planes, and they just start working that wood down. They don't even use sandpaper. They cook their own hide glue and make their own varnishes.
Wow. I tell you what, we're going to continue on that conversation about Brian Derber and a whole lot more with our guest today, Mike Beano, right after this look at the news. You know, even in the bitter cold, Wisconsin is a special place. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. And Mike Beano back with us, author of our editor of Our Wisconsin magazine, is here to talk about some of those special things about the state. His magazine, packed with stories, photos, recipes, and they're all about the things that make Wisconsin unique. So, as we talk with Mike, I want to hear from you. What are some of your favorite places or events? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And as we broke for news, you were talking about Brian Derber and the fabulous job that he does in creating world-class violins. You actually visited his school, did you not?
I did. His school actually is about 5 miles down the road from where I live up here in Presque Isle. And it is on a beautiful little lake. There's a walkout basement on his home, and that, with natural light, is where this shop is located and where people from all around North America come to study. Those students are required to build 6 instruments in the violin family by hand. The first 3 are violins done completely with hand tools. The 4th is viola. Then the student may choose from a violin, viola, or cello for the remaining 2. Again, 4,000 hours of direct instruction. They live there and work. And very interesting. And Brian has, within the last year, bailed together a book called The Manual of Violin Making. It's 473 pages and weighs 8 pounds. He's sold them to people in Australia, China, Indonesia, Germany, Spain, Ireland, you name it, even Italy. So that's what's going on here back in the woods, and you never would have thunk it.
No, you sure wouldn't. Well, one thing that we do know a whole lot about is the, I think for at least many people here in the state, is the Birkebeiner. And I think it looks like there's going to be plenty of snow up there. Is there not for the Birky?
There's some snow. It's mostly cold, freezing weather, but the Birky is on. There is snow here. I think in Madison, Milwaukee recently got pounded a little harder, but it's up and running and it's going. Have you ever been there when that race is finishing, Larry?
I have not.
You know, I got to experience this last year in February, and this year's Birky is the 45th, by the way, and it happens February 21st to 24th, and it's North America's greatest, biggest cross-country ski race. 40,000 people come to see about 10,000 skiers across 4 days of different events of varying lengths. But that day, when the big race is coming in, it's Saturday, and these skiers have trekked 55K. They're from all over the world, and they come from Cable into Hayward, and they've got a Birkebeiner bridge that takes people over, the skiers over the highway, and deposits them right onto Main Street. It's lined with every cowbell is ringing from Dairyland, people cheering these folks on the way in. And these are some of the best athletes in the world when it comes to skiing. I mean, they're from all over. They've been training all year. So you get the real serious folks in Lycra coming across the finish line and, you know, just busting a gut to get there, and they're skiing for time. That's great. It's exciting. Church bells tolling as they're coming into town. Then the fun starts when the people who really are just out there for fun, there are costumes. I watched a lion with about a 10-foot tail skiing across the finish line. I watched some guy carrying a house cat in one arm and holding pulling his way with one pole. It's the costumes and the fun they're having is just amazing, and it's Molly and the Haymakers, a band that went and became famous in Nashville, but are from right up there in that neighborhood. They're playing. It's a huge, wonderful event, and if you haven't seen it, just to go there, people watching really is worthwhile.
And it's really got an interesting history, which you talk about in the magazine, and it's kind of fun to read about it.
Sure, there's frivolity, but the Norwegians, people of Norwegian heritage in Wisconsin, take this very seriously. Tony Wise, who used to run the Telemark Resort, the late Tony Wise, Norwegian, he was the prime mover in getting this race started, and back around 74, and they did it in reverse then. They went from Hayward toward Cable. But this dates actually to the 1200s in Norway, where there was a civil war going on, and the king dispatched 2 of his toughest warriors to carry to safety his infant son, who would be the prince. And in this uprising, they were after this lineage. So these warriors took the kid, 18 months old, in backpacks and switched off. And these warriors were called Birky Binders. They were peasants who wore birch bark leggings, and that's what they wore for protection as they hammered their way through the woods and through the mountains and the mountain passes in Norway. And they went 55 kilometers from Lillehammer to Trondheim. That's why the race now is 55K. It's done. It's recreated in Norway every year, that's why, and what we're doing here really follows that. That infant prince later ultimately returned to claim the throne, and he became Norway's longest seated king.
Yeah, it's a great story, really a great story. You know, a listener called to say the Knickerbocker Ice Festival in Lake Mills is this weekend, February 1st and 2nd. And they have ice sculptures, a frozen fish tossed, a trivia contest, a Stonehenge model made out of ice on the lake, and a lot of other fun stuff. And it celebrates Knickerbocker Ice Company that used to harvest ice on Rock Lake.
Oh, wow. Well, you know what? If somebody has a little story about that Icehenge sculpture, we sure would like to chase that one. Somebody suggested it to us, then I think he moved to Utah or something like that and dropped off the map. But most of the stories in this magazine come from tips from regular readers out there, sometimes the listeners who come on your show, and you just shared a good one. So if anybody's going to be out there and you get some outstanding photography of that Icehenge, and perhaps the name of the folks that are doing this, we'll get on it and we'll report that in an upcoming issue, I'm sure.
That sounds great. And actually, you've got a story about ice harvesting in your magazine this time around.
We do. And, you know, the Iceman is before your time and my time, Larry. But yeah. In the 1920s and 30s, the Iceman was quite a welcome and necessary person in all of our neighborhoods. You know, the first refrigerator, widely used ones in homes, came out about 1923. That was Frigidaire. My grandparents forever said, put that into Frigidaire, Mike. that's a refrigerator. Why are you calling it a Frigidaire? That's why. So the Iceman was very necessary in our neighborhoods because if he didn't bring ice, you didn't get cold milk in Dairyland. That's a travesty. So to keep our foods cool, you had an ice box, and these are considered antiques now. But the Iceman came, and you had a card in your window indicating how many pounds you'd like, and he'd come with his horse-drawn wagon, later with a truck, with ice under canvas that he would chisel off, weigh on a little scale. The kids would follow him around trying to get some chips that they could suck and slip down each other's backs on a hot day. And they'd follow the friendly Iceman around as he made his rounds. It's a lot of work in hot weather, but that work extended into the cold. And we have a story from Don Nass of Jefferson, who was an Iceman, I believe. Don might be in his early 90s, but Don recounts the days from Jefferson on the Rock River when his father, Ernst Nass, was an Iceman. And Ernst ran the Home Lumber Company. And in the wintertime, well, if you ran a lumber yard, what do you do in the winter? Well, in the winter, he'd assemble a crew of 25, and they'd go out on the Rock River and saw this ice and fill an ice house, and that ice would keep all the way into August if they did it right. He'd get a crew of 25 in a gigantic circular saw with an engine, and they'd take this thing out there, and they'd saw grooves in the ice, and they would not saw all the way through. And they had people coming by with poles, pinch poles, and they would break off these cakes of ice, and they had cut a channel, and they would float those things to the ice house on shore. Now, that saw was so loud they could hear that thing 2 miles down the river. It threw ice 100 feet in the air, and I don't doubt that. They're so powerful. They'd take these cakes, and they would attach them with ropes, and they'd gather them with a the tool will come to me here in a moment, but it was a piece of metal shaped like a triangle, and they would attach that to a rope, a pulley on the ice house, and pull the whole train of ice chunks up a slide and direct them into the ice house. They'd use marsh hay in between every cake and fill that thing up. Hard work. And sometimes they fell in the river, but nobody drowned. That was the start of the work, because come May, all the way through August, they had to take the ice out of there, load it onto the trucks, and then haul it around town. And the hotter it got, the harder they had to work, because the demand for ice went up, and the ice in the house would melt together into one gigantic glacier that they had to chisel the ice off of and drag with huge tongs. And every one of these ice men walked for the rest of his life with a kind of a stoop in his shoulder, and walked a little off kilter. They pine for those days, except when they think about their shoulder.
Oh, man. Mike in Mercer has something for us, so let's go there. Mike, hi.
Hi, Larry. I've talked to you and Mike about the Turtle River Pursuit in the past. Wisconsin Public Radio is one of our sponsors.
Yep.
And we're having the inaugural cross-country ski race in Mercer on February 9th and at the Mecca Trails and at the Windman Trails in Manitouche Waters in Winchester on February 10th. So it's the Saturday event is a classic striding event. The Sunday event is freestyle, so you can skate, ski, or stride. And it's going to be, we've got a great weather forecast that's above zero taking shape in the 10-day forecast. We've had great snow up in Mercer and Manitouche Waters, so we're expecting a fantastic event.
And again, the date for that, Mike? The date?
Saturday, February 9th, and Sunday, February 10th. So it's a combined time event where your finish time on Saturday will determine your start time on Sunday for individuals and two-person teams.
It sounds like a lot of fun, and Wisconsin Public Radio is kind of one of the sponsors for that, Mike Beano.
I think that's a worthy thing. Mike and Mercer, correct me, this is the very first, the inaugural event here, is it not?
Yeah, many years ago, or a dozen years ago, we had the Stormy Cromer Pursuit, which was a two-day event up in Montreal, Wisconsin, and Mercer. And so we've kind of rebirthed that and renamed it the Turtle River Pursuit in honor of the river that winds through Winchester, Manitouche Waters, and Mercer on its way to the Turtle Flambeau Flowage. This will be the first running of the Turtle River Pursuit.
Well, this is great because you not only have the Mecca Trails, which is long established up in Mercer, but you got the Windman Trails now right on the edge of Winchester and Manitouche Waters. Used to be a paper company land, but it is groomed. There are trails, wide trails through there for skate skiing and everything else. And so you've got a 1-2 punch here, two really strong trail systems, and it's wise to combine it into your own race for a couple of days. People are looking forward to this one, and I'm seeing signage just down the road from the office here.
Mike, thank you so much. Appreciate that call. I want to give Louise in Platteville a chance to join in. Hi, Louise.
Good morning, or I guess it's afternoon now. I was calling to say that I remember when my aunt and uncle lived in a third-floor apartment on Main Street in Platteville, and they had an icebox, which just really intrigued me. And the iceman would have to bring the ice all the way up to the third floor, and the ice came from what was called Horn's Pond at that time. Now, you have to be a little bit older to remember Horn's Pond in Platteville, because pond is long since gone, but that was where the ice came from. And there was a tray which caught the ice as it melted, and of course that had to be emptied frequently. If not, then of course you had water in your refrigerator, which wasn't good, or it just overflowed. And so I do remember the icebox. It was square. It sat on a couple of short legs. And the ice was put in up on top. So I that's the only one that I remember of seeing, but I do know that, of course, they were very common at that time. So I just thought I would inject that into your conversation that, yes, icebox really did exist, and the people now can't imagine having a chunk of ice brought to cool your food. But time moves on. So thank you, Larry. I appreciate your program and enjoy it every day.
Thanks, Louise, very much for calling. And you know what, Mike? I can remember my, you know, you mentioned that people called their refrigerator the Frigidaire, but my grandmother, Mueller, actually called the refrigerator the icebox.
Yeah, put that in the icebox. Yeah.
Put that in the icebox, she'd say, even though it wasn't no longer, it was a refrigerator, but it was called an icebox.
I think I remember some of that, too. Put it in the icebox.
Oh, man. Well, Louise, thanks so much for that call. Appreciate it. And, you know, these things that we've been talking about are, you're going to find as you open up our Wisconsin magazine, there's a whole lot more in there that we haven't covered. One of the things, as long as we're on snow, I thought it was kind of cool, the interest in vintage snowmobiles. There's something called the Snow Bowl, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and there's going to be, that's in Tichita, that's near Fond du Lac. There is going to be an event at the Snow Bowl here February 2nd, Saturday. I'll talk about that in a moment. But, yeah, we received snowmobiling goes back in a long ways in Wisconsin. The snowmobile was invented here. But in the early 70s, 1969, down around Fond du Lac, Carl Kiekhafer, who was the founder of Mercury Marine, they were building snowmobiles at the time, and he donated a tract of land to the town of Tichita and asked if they would, for a park, and asked if they would consider, along with this donation, making a snowmobile track, a half-mile oval, to race machines. Now, everybody's, I think, is familiar with the championship derby in Three Lakes. That goes back even further. But at this time in Fondy, there were some national races that were held at this Snow Bowl track that they built there. So it went on for some years, and along about 77, I think Mercury got out of the snowmobile business, and soon after that, the Snow Bowl was left idle. About 40 years, kind of getting overgrown. And in 2015, I believe, a local club, snowmobile club, the Holy Land Snow Flyers of Mount Calvary, asked if they could bring the old track back. So several clubs got involved and did some tree cutting and grubbing and brushing and cleared it all out. And they started a little event for vintage snowmobiles, antique snowmobiles, and some of the oldest ones that were run in the 60s and 70s come out there, and they let everybody, it's not a race, they let everybody who has, like, you know, 100 antique sleds come out, and they take a casual lap around the old Snow Bowl, where they used to have a three-day event, and it was a pretty big deal back in the day, but they commemorate that now, and there's an event tied to it, you know, with some cross-country skiing and tubing and food and all of that. It's for the whole family. So Saturday, February 2nd at Kiekhafer Park in Tichita, they're going to have another one of these vintage snowmobile rallies, and you might get a chance to take a little easy ride around the track and visit with some of these people who restore these machines. It's another example of a fun event out there, something to do in wintertime.
Well, I tell you what, it's always fun to talk with you, Mike, and I know we haven't gotten into so many of the, there's so many more stories in the magazine, and I wish we had more time to talk about it, but we're out of time. I even took a look at the recipes, and there's one in there that I'm thinking about trying out. And we'll probably talk about that again. How do people get subscriptions or magazine copies?
Okay. There's a real simple way. If you'd like to subscribe or get a sample issue, you can give a call to 877-902-9760 or visit ourwisconsinmag.com.
There you go. 715-920-8760 or go to ourwisconsinmag.com. Mike Bino, our guest. Thanks again, Mike. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
Mike Bino is the editor of Our Wisconsin Magazine. It's always fun to talk with him about what they're covering. They cover a heck of a lot in that magazine, always about Wisconsin. Well, tomorrow we'll talk about wetlands with the Natural Resources Foundation, so join us for that. In the meantime, though, stay with us because there's lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.